Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Good morning or afternoon, wherever you are, everybody. This is Bill Reed.
And John Becker.
With Building Deeper Green. And we are here probably, what are we on, our 10th or 11th episode?
It's 11.
Amazing. We are working on an arc, a narrative arc, of working with the aspects of sustainability, energy, water, materials, habitat, consciousness. Today, we are beginning the process of knitting those pieces together. One of the issues about green building is that we work with aspects of a whole system, and we try to knit them together, and it's continually ineffective, meaning while we're working towards a condition of sustainability, we certainly haven't achieved that yet. And the question is, will we ever achieve it by working on individual aspects, and 30% energy savings and 20% water use savings, et cetera? It requires a whole lot of different activities going on together, and the show has been about all those different elements. So the question is, green building talks a lot about LEED, for instance, and BREEAM and Green Star and these other rating systems in the world talk about what we do, how we measure it. Integrative design, which we've woven through the show, talks about how we do it, and now we're talking about how we got into the aspects of living systems. It's pretty easy to measure energy. It's pretty easy to measure water. But how do we measure the quality of life?
Yeah, and as a trained architect, we were always taught, and for most of my career, about looking at a place and understanding a place. But for the most part, it took me a very long time to realize that what I was really looking at were the objects of that place rather than the meaning of that place. So the title of today's show is How Can Development be used to understand and sustain life. And I think underneath that is really the purpose of discovering the meaning of place.
So, yeah, so how do we understand life, and how do we communicate that to our clients and the communities we're working with?
Well, I think, Bill, one of the first things that comes to mind is just the term development. I mean, that's a pretty weird word, right?
Well,
what does it really mean?
Yeah, we don't think it's weird because we use it automatically. So what does it mean?
All right, well, how would you define it?
Well, let's define it the way most people do. Develop means to create something that adds value.
All right,
I don't even know if we think about it in that level of sophistication. It means we're building homes or buildings on a piece of land.
Okay, so define value.
So value means we're improving the value. What's the value-add proposition that we're developing?
Generally speaking, I think that when we use the term development, that value is defined in terms of economic value.
Right.
Alone, almost
right.
In isolation.
Right. Yep.
Okay.
So is that sufficient?
Well, I think in our prior episodes, we've talked a lot about how, of course, that's not sufficient. And, in fact, one of the ways that I think repeatedly a thread that seems to have emerged, I think, Bill, in all these episodes is the power of story in learning how we can create new potential, which really is the definition on a more comprehensive level of the term development.
Well, before we get to story, which is really important, what the story represents is pattern. What patterns represent are the invisible relationships between the objects. So we're very good in our society about talking about objects, buildings, automobiles, roads that we have to build. The question is, life doesn't really depend on just the objects. Life depends on how these objects are in relationship to other, how soil is in relationship to trees, is relationship to air, is relationship to quality water, is relationship to how the humans and animals use them. So those relationships are invisible and very hard to talk about. And how do you actually capture that invisibility? Because this is really important. This is not abstract. Because if we are truly talking about a sustainable condition, we need to be talking about how do we sustain life.
Yeah, and I think that it is through those stories and understanding, in essence, the whole story of a place by understanding the contributing stories of a place that we can begin to discover the meaning of the place and therefore participate in co-evolving with its health.
that note,
let's introduce Joel.
We're probably ready to introduce our guest.
Well, Joel is an applied naturalist. He is a principal in a firm called Regenesis. And Joel, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I guess the first question is, Joel, what is it that you do?
Or what's an applied naturalist?
Yeah, that's actually a really good question.
That's one of the reasons that I like that term, is because it makes people sort of sit up and ask, that's interesting, what does that mean? A naturalist understands how particular places live. Bill was talking about understanding life, and I think that understanding life in general is a very hard thing to do, but understanding life in particular places is something that's not only doable, but exciting and intriguing and also enlightening, because if we understand how life works in particular places, then we can understand how we can contribute to that in those particular places. So that's the applied aspect of applied naturalist.
So the applied piece, Joel, is human participation in the life of that place?
Exactly, which is always a part of places. And we're always doing things, and if we're unconscious of how the life of that place works, then we can do all kinds of damage, as we're very aware of. And it's sort of like having a relationship. If I had absolutely no knowledge or understanding of my partner, I would be stepping on their toes constantly. And the more intimately I know and understand them, the more beautifully we can relate and dance together and more productively work together.
So how do you go about understanding a place, then?
Well, there are several levels to it.
Wait, I want to take a step back first. I want to make sure that we are aware of the importance of why it's important to understand place. I mean, why is each place unique? Or how are each place? We have a tendency to abstract places in generic terms.
Actually, Bill, I would suggest you just answered the question.
Okay.
That, for me at least, the reason we need to understand a place and the meaning of it is because each place is so incredibly unique.
But what we've done, though, on the planet is we take aspects of a place that kind of appeal to us. As an architect, I always winced when a client would say, we want shutters on our building, or we want a Palladian window, even though it may not have done had anything to do with the context or the kind of lifestyle they wanted to lead. But they love the peace.
Or the building's all about primarily focusing views where you have the best views.
Right.
Which is not a bad thing. But
that's a classic, but that is an aspect. Or we take a beautiful Italian hill town. We say, this is the most beautiful place I've ever been. How can I locate that in Phoenix, Arizona, or even Disneyland?
Well, that's exactly what we've done at Epcot, for example.
Or Celebration.
Well, Celebration's a different kind of a thing. I'm thinking about trying to recreate a given cultural context in a place outside of it where that context was born at a place like Epcot,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
But what's really fascinating about that is that the places that were born of their place, such as you mentioned a Tuscan hill town, are the places that humans want to go to. They've become, you know, vacation destinations. I think it's because the energy in that place is so reflective of the meaning of that place and the understanding of that place.
So when we take places and we abstract them and say, I want this here and there, we actually are imposing a will on that. We're imposing an artificial construct on a place. It seems to me we've done that all over the planet.
So, Joel, in terms of, or if one wants to avoid doing that, how does one begin to understand a place?
Okay, so again, excuse me, there are several levels of doing that. So I always think about it as being similar to when one meets someone new for the first time, that there's a whole level of seeing their attributes, how tall they are, what color their eyes and their hair is, all of those kinds of direct physical attributes. And then one often starts to hear their life story, which is really about how they've been performed and how they've reacted to things.
So, Joel, pause just for a sec. So the physical attributes are still important. They're just insufficient, right?
Oh, absolutely. So okay. In terms of a place, it's important to understand the topography. It's probably the primary physical attributes that are essential. And again, any of these distinctions are somewhat arbitrary, that they blur into one another. There's not a rigid distinction between the physical attributes of anything and how it acts or behaves or even its nature. It's just that there's a lot more to everything than simply those measurable physical attributes.
And I'm going to go back to that term invisible. What we're really looking for to really understand people and places are those relationships between with the relationship. The way I understand a person is how they are in relationship to their family or parents or kids or the dog in the street. That relationshipal aspect tells us a lot more. It's still incomplete, but it tells us a lot more than just looking at the features alone.
So how would that translate into understanding a place again?
Okay, so there's first, what are the physical things? The topography, what's the geology? What are the not only the rocks that are underneath, but what are the geological processes that form this place? And then what are the soils that are there? And again, the question is not just what are the soils that are there, but what do they tell us about how this place formed and then what is possible there? Because a piece of what Bill is pointing out is we're always looking at not only what is it physically and not only how does it function and operate and move, but also what is it doing and how can we then best relate to it, interact with it, to help to enable it to do those things better in ways or in entirely new ways. So one of the ways I always think about things is the earth is like our bodies, and every part of the earth is playing a role or probably multiple roles, a system of roles. Just like every part of our body is playing multiple roles. Our heart is beating blood, pumping blood around our body. Our liver is filtering blood. There are various specific roles that are being played by each portion of our body.
Joel, I have to interrupt you there for just a
sure.
sec. We do have to go to a break, but we'll return in just a moment using the body description that Joel's talking about, so we'll see you in just a moment.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
on the web at skillsusa.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We are speaking today with our guest, Joel Glansberg, and Joel was using a metaphor to help us understand places. Joel, you were using the human body as a metaphor, so why don't you continue?
Sure. So I was talking about how the Earth is alive, just like our bodies are alive. And every portion of the Earth is playing specific roles, just as every portion of our body is playing specific roles, whether it's the heart or the lungs or the liver or our finger. And there are often multiple roles that each part of our body is playing. And if you think about in our body, the heart is playing specific roles within a system, a circulatory system. So it's pumping blood throughout that circulatory system that is also nourishing our body, taking food, nutrients from our food to our body, every cell in our bodies, taking oxygen to every cell in our bodies, and also taking waste away. So the circulatory system is not just getting blood to places, it's helping to enable the roles of other systems of the body. It's helping to enable our respiratory system to do what it does, as well as our digestive system. So we need to look at places not only as how they function and what role they're playing, but their roles within larger systems. And if we're ignorant of, for instance, the role our heart is playing in our bodies, if we're developing our heart in ignorance of that, we may easily compromise its ability to play those roles. And the same is true for places on the earth. If we're ignorant of the roles it's playing, we could easily compromise its ability. So if we're simply aware of the roles that it's playing, we can't help but be better at ensuring that what we're doing is enabling it to play those roles better.
So you're saying then that each place has a role in a much larger system, let's say a watershed, for example.
Well, exactly.
And even before we go to a watershed, let's take it from the world of architecture and planners, is that a house is part of a neighborhood, and the neighborhood is part of a city or a community, and that's part of a city, part of a region. And if we're not aware of the health and the interrelationships of those interactions just from a physical planning perspective, we're going to mess it up.
But then on the other side of it, there are subsystems that go in smaller scale that are nested within the place also, right?
Oh, absolutely. So I want to riff off of what Bill was just talking about a moment ago. We probably all have memories from times in our lives when we lived in a neighborhood that we really enjoyed. And maybe there was a store or a bar or a park or something, even at colleges and universities, you often have people having strong memories of particular buildings or places there. And that when those things are removed, the culture of the place often falls apart, or it becomes very different. And so we also have similar things within any building, places that work really well or make the whole building work. And they mainly have to do with how people interact and when they interact. And so the same things that are true for human beings are true for everything else that's alive, any other living system. So we always need to start with what we understand well. So if we're going to understand how watersheds work and we have a strong understanding of architecture and how human beings interact with the built environment, that gives us our clues of how to think about the watershed. If we understand things on a watershed level, that then helps us understand how we should design our built environment.
So, Joel.
No, go ahead.
This is something that comes up all the time when people who are overwhelmed. I mean, most architects coming out of school barely know how to design a good bathroom. And then we add green building on top of it, and energy modeling, and water balancing, and materials issues, and they're kind of rolling. Their heads are rolling, and developers and designers they're overwhelmed with information and issues. And then we add on this layer of seeming complexity on top of it. And I'm kind of creating a leading question here, but I'm just curious how you would respond to somebody saying, stop, this is way too much to handle. We can't even make a building energy efficient. What the heck are we talking about this level of work for?
Okay, good.
I have a perspective on this, but I just wanted to, like I said, it's a leading question or a leading comment, but I wanted to see how you would address that from the world of practicality, somebody saying, stop already.
Well, I think we were talking before the show about what that difference between science and art.
Mm.
And that what makes anything special is that level of art. And within the arts, let's take classical music for a moment. The science of it sets the threshold. One needs to be able to read music, be able to hit the right notes at the right time on one's instrument. That's simply the threshold before one even begins to practice and professionally.
And recognize what those notes represent.
And the level of artistry that's above that is the feeling that's put into that. And exactly how human feeling is conveyed through the manipulation of an instrument is a little bit of a mystery, but it's something that we're all aware of. And it seems to me that another aspect of artistry is that there's a fluidity to it, unlike my speech, that there is... it's not laborious, and it seems to me that that's what we're aiming for in all of our practices, whether it's in the practice of architecture or in the practice of cooking and nutrition or education, is that we need to get down how to do the physical aspects to it, but that's easily fragmenting. And it's how we bring all of those things together in a beautiful whole that is what makes them sing.
So are you then saying that when you're trying to understand a place, there are, of course, the scientific components of measuring its attributes, but there's also a practice of artistry?
Absolutely.
Is it ineffable to try and pursue how you do that?
I think we could at least make a stab at it. So the first aspects, as we were talking about earlier, are very physical, and they're often portrayed on maps. Geology, soils, topography, water, what the watershed is like, what the various flows are, the winds at different times, the people at different times, wildlife corridors, plant and animal communities, and those give us pictures. And one could have those pictures throughout time. But one needs to start to see that as a movie. So how did the geology move and create these landforms? And then the plants and animals that worked with the climate to form the soils, and then the evolutions of plant and animal communities through the ice ages, and then the Holocene, the warming after that, and how did those systems evolve? Which starts to give us a sense of the potential of a place.
And how did humans begin to occupy or be in a place?
Exactly, and then how humans begin to occupy it and be in that place. And that always gives us a clue of good ways to be in places. When people have been in places for thousands of years and help to increase their species diversity and their nutrient cycling and water cycling and things like that, that starts to indicate patterns of behavior that are based on understanding the patterns of the life of those places. And the what may be a bit ineffable, but is certainly something that we can talk about, is that every place I've ever worked has what I would call a personality or a flavor. And that personality or flavor comes through in its natural history, in its human history, in the ways that people talk about it, in the names that people choose for places.
I want to interject there. It used to be that developers, in working with their communities, worked in their communities. And they had a sense of responsibility and a sense of knowledge. And this gets back to the master builder idea that we've introduced before. The master builder knew the community that he was part of and the local workforce skills and the economy and the culture. And what could come out of that work was a building or a larger complex that was inevitably part of its place. What we've done today is we've abstracted that and we've created the shopping mall and the Banana Republics and Gap stores that go everywhere from any city in the world. Because we've industrialized the process of development. And so this approach seems to me, Joel, that we are actually hoping to inspire people to look back with a different way of understanding a place and not just abstracting it into a mechanical process. So how do we do that?
Well, I want to go back for one moment to what you were just talking about. There's a very interesting thing that occurred early on in the Industrial Revolution. And initially, factory owners lived in the towns where their factories were. And all of the executives lived there, and industrial towns were quite nice. And there was a big change that occurred when factory owners lived elsewhere. And the executives lived elsewhere, because then the places where their factories were, the people who worked in those factories could all become abstractions. They were no longer their neighbors. They were no longer their hometown. They were no longer their communities.
Because they weren't of that place.
Because they weren't of that place. It's very difficult to care about an abstraction. It's very difficult to care about someone you've never met or never seen.
Or don't know.
Or don't know, exactly. And that all of us, I'm sure, have worked on projects where the architect has spent very little time, if any, on the site. I remember years ago looking at a set of blueprints for a home that was a few thousand square feet, and it was a ranch style. It was all on a single level, and the site was a hillside. And in order to have built that building there, the amount of cut and fill would have been incredible. When we all know that designing a building to fit a site in an elegant way is not only an interesting challenge, but brings in the true creativity and artistry of architecture.
Okay, on that note, let's hold that artistry aspect, and we're going to take a break. We'll be back in a minute or so. Bye, everybody. Nope, bye. Hold on.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey, y'all, this is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity, Thanks USA, does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here with our guest, Joel Glansberg, talking about the nature of understanding living systems. And Joel, we left off with the idea of working with an understanding of the people and attributes, the unique attributes of each place. Do you want to pick up there?
Through artistry.
Ah, yes, through artistry.
Right. Yes, yeah, so the artistry in everything, the creativity in everything, has to do with responding to something that restrains us. That when we're trying to build a building or a community or whatever it is, that in the abstract world, there are no restraints. We do whatever we like in whatever way we want to. And John was talking earlier about Italian hill towns or various architectural styles around the world. And those styles were created based on the restraints of the place.
So, for example, the extraordinary verticality and flying buttresses of the medieval cathedral, the constraint was gravity.
Exactly. Or in the hill towns, it was partially the limited amount of arable lands, not wanting to build on those, building on the hilltops for defense as well, and how would that function? And as Bill was alluding to earlier, we tried to imitate what turned out to be a beautiful architectural solution, not understanding that part of the beauty and elegance of that solution is that it was responding to a particular place and the life of those places. So,
The constraints in those places, I think, right?
The constraints in those places, which have everything to do with how that place is, how that place processes and functions, the life of that place. So in trying to understand the life of any place, we start out, as we were saying before, looking at the physical attributes, but looking for the relationships. So just as we were talking about the relationships between the circulatory system and the respiratory system and the digestive system, what are the relationships between various portions of the place? What are the relationships between the various things that are living there? So how do the animals relate to the plants that are there that are creating the soils? One of the things that we don't think about in the Great Plains are how the bison and the grasslands co-evolved one another. The pattern of the movements of the bison through the prairies had everything to do with how the plants that grew there grew, being eaten and trampled by the bison and then being left alone for 6 months or 12 months before they came back again for that heavy impact. There's a great story from Yellowstone National Park, and this is about how wolves determine the temperature of water. And basically, when wolves were reintroduced to Yellowstone, they kept all the herbivores, all the big animals that were grazing and eating plants, out of the rivers.
Like elk?
Like elk, moose, bighorn sheep, deer, that in the absence of predators, they had hung out all day basically along the rivers, ate all the willows, and ate all the grass close to the rivers so that the banks were eroding when there were floods. The willows were no longer holding the soil together and were no longer shading the water. So when wolves were reintroduced, they would come to the river to drink all the big animals, and then they would go back up into the uplands to graze most of the day, staying bunched together. So all the willows started to grow back. The lush growth along the streams and rivers started to grow back. It held the soil so that the water was clean and clear. It shaded the water so it was cooler, and when the water is cooler, it can hold more oxygen, and so there were greater populations of trout.
And so one of the roles of the wolves then was to act as a constraining force.
Exactly. And so that it's the relationship. One of the things we often miss is that the way in which the wolves are pushing on and being pushed on by the herds is what is then determining whether or not those herds are playing their roles in the larger system in a functional way so that the grazing that they're doing is helping to increase the stability of the land and increase the health of the land as well as the water that flows through it. So those are the kinds of patterns that we're looking for always.
And they're always different, yet they're always the same.
Okay, but now let's say humans are interacting with those patterns. What is it about understanding those patterns that can help us determine how to participate in the health of that place?
Great. So humans are often playing a role similar to the wolves. Mm-hmm. So in an agricultural setting, grazing animals need to be managed in exactly the same way that the wolves were managing the herds at Yellowstone. They need to be moved in a way that's appropriate for that landscape and that climate. Similar thing is true for where and how we build our infrastructure. That if we build our infrastructure indiscriminately and not understanding the relationships within a place, we can destroy them. So, for instance, if we're putting roads... was working on a project in South Carolina, and this was along the lower reaches of a river that went into the ocean, and so it was in the estuary portion of the river. So the tides came in and the tides went out. The tides came in and the tides went out. And one of the things that's important about tidal flows in the streams that are coming off of the river is that they're nurseries. That's where many of the species that live in the ocean or live in the estuary are hatched and where they are when they are young. And as they come from the freshwater into the saltwater, they go through a very gradual gradation of increasing salinity. When we build roads along the river, because it's an easy path and we want to see the river and it's where we want to put our homes and businesses, and we make all the crossings across those streams culverted, we constrict those exchanges. And so you have very fresh water, and then right by the culvert it starts to get salty, and you get beyond that culvert and it's very densely salty. So that all of the species that are going across that gradation, it's much more difficult for them to survive, and you have lost many of the different levels of salinity that different species of plants and animals could live in. So simply the way we build infrastructure like road crossings over creeks can have a lot to do with whether or not we enable those places to play the roles that they're used to playing. So we could create those crossings in ways that would actually make it better rather than making it worse.
So to take it to the I can imagine someone listening saying, okay, then what's the role of those species that are in those gradating estuaries?
Well, if we just want to look at the plants for a moment, there's been a lot of talk about the floods in New Orleans, that it was by various infrastructure that was built, whether it was canals or levees or whatever it was, parking lots. By the way those were built, it destroyed the wetlands that contained the plants that were able previously to absorb the big flows of water and to also absorb the heavy winds and the tidal flows.
Great. So in that example you just used, what's fascinating is, all right, you've clearly identified how we might make a different decision in order not to do damage, but how can that also teach us how we can make decisions that not only don't do damage, but actually improve the health of life in a place?
Okay, great. So let's talk for a moment about New Orleans, a moment longer. If we had understand that place well, even if you look at the French, when they first laid out lots along the Mississippi Delta, basically your lot, your building lot, had three boundaries and was open on the fourth side because that's where the river was, because they were aware that the water in the Delta was going to constantly move the river back and forth.
Because that river's always moving.
The river's always moving. It's always depositing silt. It's everything is in flux there. And if the city of New Orleans had been built in a way that was aware of that, we might actually have had a city that had waterways throughout it and wetlands throughout it so that the people living there were themselves complexifying the wetlands and the waterways and that interface between land and water and plants that provided the clean water, that provided the food for all of the fish. Think about just the cuisine from southern Louisiana. It's entirely based on how that delta is functioning in relationship to the ocean.
I just had a vision of a really healthy Venice.
Exactly. So that transportation within the city could have been on waterways, that wetlands within the city could have treated the wastewater from the city, been the nurseries for the plants and animals throughout the delta, for the estuary, and people could be getting oysters and clams and shrimp right off their back porch, basically, so that there's not a distinction between we need to create flat land here to have the city on, and over there is the water, and we have to keep it out with the levee, that place has never functioned in that way, that's a model of city that we've taken from somewhere else.
Okay, Joel, got to stop you here for a break, and let's come back with that thought, and then how to work, weave a pattern into motivation for people to begin that change process.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water! Everybody, out of the water immediately!
Dude, is that... It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom who's been swimming a lot with her kids must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count, minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk, which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everybody. And we were, Joel Glansberg, our guest, was explaining to us how a pattern understanding can impact our understanding of place and what that might mean for design. And we're, since this is our last segment, I would like to move us into now taking how we take those patterns and actually begin to engage a community or in a design team around being motivated to do that. Joel,
okay.
You have some thoughts on that?
Yes, we were just talking a moment ago about New Orleans and how understanding the patterns of how that place functioned as an ecosystem and within larger ecosystems would enable a different designing of the city that would enable that place to continue to play the roles it's been playing. And one of the things that's striking to me is when we get those images, just in describing John saying, oh, I see a very healthy Venice, but it wouldn't be a Venice. You can, if you think about the New Orleans cuisine and think of how it comes right from those ecosystems and those smells and those ways of being, you start to have images in your mind. And those are images of relationships.
And people would occupy the place entirely differently.
Right. And it has everything to do with the story that they're living out. So is the story that the story they might be living out is one of people being integrated with the lower Mississippi Delta and what was happening, how everything they did influenced what they could drink, what they could eat. Here, there's a great story from a development, Prairie Crossing, up by Chicago. And a guy was doing research, and he called the homeowners at Prairie Crossing, where all of the homeowners had been required to plant a portion of their yards to native prairie plants. And pretty soon, everybody was planting large portions of their yards to native prairie plants. And the thing that was striking to the interviewer was that all of these homeowners could tell him why it was important to have deep-rooted prairie plants in their yards instead of fertilized turf grass, and how the deep-rooted plants, which were what that land had been covered with previously, enabled the water to be cleaned so that they could swim in the ponds at the bottom of their street, so that they clearly understood how their places functioned, and they understood it through a story of their place. This is a prairie. It's even interesting to me, names that we give to things. There's a great one, Prairie Crossing. You immediately understand something about the nature, and it's telling the story of the place. When we have Aspen Creek in the driest part of Santa Fe as the name of a development, it's a name that's geared to marketing rather than telling the story of the place. So,
without meaning.
Without meaning, entirely. And it's engaging people in a process to find out from the people that already live there what they love about that place so that you can understand the nature of the place. That's really what a story is about.
Wow.
It's understanding the nature of anything.
Even that name, I mean, yeah, it does have a meaning, but not the meaning of the place. Thereby, it functions to separate people from the place.
Exactly.
And make them cynical.
Yeah.
It's a story that has no integrity.
Yeah. So the process about love and understanding, I actually want to flip that. In order to love someone, let's go back to anthropomorphizing this. In order to love someone, we need to understand them. And yet, in order to continue to love them, we have to understand them further. So it seems that the design process that you're talking about, Joel, is one of engaging people in understanding the place.
So that they can love the place and thereby participate in taking care of it.
Taking care of it.
Right, because if we don't understand a place or a person, like you're saying, and this comes back to the mechanical thing, right? If having a relationship of any sort needs that kind of intimate understanding so one can relate well. If we do everything really well scientifically or mechanically, it's like making love mechanically. That there has to be a kind of love and intimacy and understanding so that that relationship can go in both directions.
And even better, passion. I mean, passion that actually will protect this place, care for this place, help it to recover, help it to restore and regenerate.
Right. And with the example of New Orleans, one can easily see that. If the story is of being the steward of the Mississippi Delta and enabling the flowering of the Mississippi Delta, that's a very different story to be living out than the one that's been lived out recently, which has to do very much with the haves and the have-nots.
So there are some architects and planners that can come in and kind of, they understand the need to do that, and they can sometimes, I don't know how often, probably not very many times, begin to embody the nature of that place in their designs. But it seems that the nature of design has to change in order to engage someone like you, Joel, to help people experience the place, the entire design team, and maybe key aspects of the community, so that they can begin to engage at a much more whole and healthy level. Is that a fair statement?
I think it's really about re-envisioning what the design process means, and then the level of priority and the amount of time that goes into various portions of that process. So it's not like we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It's sort of getting a different sense of the context that design process is within.
How long does that typically take when you work with a project, Joel?
Well, it depends a bit on the scale, but it can be a month, a couple of months. We always obviously need to draw on people that know places well, whether those are naturalists with the Park Service or with state organizations or simply long-time residents, that it's always essential to talk to people that know the places very well, that we bring in generalized understandings and ways of approaching and looking at things, but that long-term love and experience of a place is indispensable in the process.
So you're dating the place for a couple of months.
Exactly.
I heard Tim Murphy say that once.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the thing about the time question that's interesting is there always seem to be key people that know places well and can communicate it well in the form of a story. And for me, before, that's been someone who wrote their doctorate dissertation in geology on the place, who could tell me in 15 minutes, waving his arms, the geological processes that had taken place there, or finding a wildlife biologist who could take me to all of the remnant pieces of native ecosystems and help me get a picture of how those all fit together. So that speeds things up considerably once we find those key people in those various areas who can share their love and their passion and their understanding of the places and the relationships within them.
Okay.
Joel, thank you. We have to say goodbye because we're running out of time. But we came across it again, Bill, where, just like Ben was talking about last time, really working with the people of the place who love the place and will thereby care for it.
And so we are
an integral part of the system, in other words, for the health of place happens to be humans.
Yeah, and so that's a good segue into, of course, what we're going to be going to the next episode. Well, that humans are an integral part of nature, and while we're attempting,
even though we've talked about that a lot,
we have, but now we actually really have to make it practical.
Right. And how do we connect the essence of a place with the essence of a person?
Right. And so in fact, it's actually one and the same. We're working, as we work with understanding the land, we're working with the people of that land. But then, how do we actually keep that relationship going? How do we build a design process to actually allow us, or allow a community, to not just end it with a design, but to continue to be part of the evolutionary processes of life in that place? That's where it happens. That's where sustainability really will only happen.
So we will be talking with our guest, Carol Sanford, in the next episode, so that we can continue to understand that to do different things, we need to do things differently.
To do things differently, we have to think about them differently.
And to think about them differently, we need to be different.
See you next week, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.